And the clerk will call the roll.
Atkinson, Bates, Bonamici, Boquist, Burdick, Carter, Devlin, Dingfelder, Ferrioli, George, Girard, Hass, Johnson, Cruz, Metzger, Montes Anderson, Monroe, Morissette, Morse, Nelson, Prozonsky, Rosenbaum, Schrader, Starr, Telfer, Berger, Walker, Whitsett, Winters, President Courtney.
Got the whole fam damnly here.
Yes. Did you meet?
I did. Yeah,
okay,
I did.
And I don't know how far you want to go if you don't want to address this in terms of posting a card. I can do it.
Why don't we do that? Have you do it? Yeah.
Okay.
I'll do it that way.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, when you do the implication, you're a little short guy. I'm going to pull this out. All right, so you can stand on here.
Told him to.
Yeah. Yeah. Speak into the mic. There you go. Just like that. Good. Excellent.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. A quorum being present, we will post the colors. The colors will be posted today by Senator Morris's grandsons, Nathan and Geo Tong. Geo Tong is assisted by his mother, Carrie Tong. The pledge will be led by Senator Whitsett.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Our invocation today will be by Senator Morris's grandson, Stephen Tong of Taichung, Taiwan, and he'll be giving the invocation.
Please bow your heads with me for the invocation. God, you say in the book of James that wisdom is not full of envy and selfish ambition, but the wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial and sincere. Peacemakers who sow in peace raise a harvest of righteousness. This is my prayer for these men and women of the Senate, that they may be full of wisdom, that they may find unity and always seek the impartial and sincere best for the people of Oregon. Finally, I ask your blessings on them as they give of themselves in service to others. In Jesus' name, I pray these things. Amen.
Courtesy to the Senate, Chair recognizes Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. President and colleagues. It is indeed an honor for me to have my family here today. Nathan, Stephen, and Gio attend the Morrison Academy in Taichung, Taiwan. It's an international school of considerable note. And I noticed that our President, Courtney, is not present today, but for his benefit, something I'm sure he does not know is the Morrison Academy is known as the Mustangs, Mr. President. So please welcome them again. Their father is he's the director of corporate responsibility, strategic planning, and works for Pouchen Nike. Now, the Pouchen company manufactures one of every five shoes made in the world today. And so he is an executive in that company, and they have chosen to live their lives in Taiwan. They have lived extensively in China as well. So, Mr. President, again, it's my honor and privilege to have my family with me here today. Also, my wife, Linda, who is with Senator Winters. And so would ask for courtesies for all my family. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you, Senator. And courtesies are extended to your three grandsons. Thank you for coming here today. And the rest of the family for joining us today. It's a real privilege to have you in your Oregon State Capitol. And thanks for helping us with the opening ceremonies today. Chair recognizes Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to introduce my intern for the session, Stacy Rothotti, from Portland State. She just graduated Friday, I think. Stand up. This has been very helpful. I can never pronounce her name. Is your name Rothotti or is it named Rothotti or Throthotti or whatever? I can never pronounce her name till today. So it's been a very, very, very nice time. She's helped us quite a lot with a lot of our research and healthcare bills, and she's a graduate in political science, I believe. And so she says it's the last day, but I think maybe it's in her blood, and so she may be down here to see how we end this session. Thank you, Mr. President.
Well, good. Thank you, Senator. And thank you for today, and thank you for your service to the Senate, and especially congratulations to you for your graduation. Chair recognizes Senator Carter.
Thank you, Mr. President. I have two guests with me today. Sitting at my desk with me, you will recognize the name of Talia Goldberg. She is the youngest daughter of Dr. Bruce Goldberg. Talia recently graduated from Lincoln High School, and while attending Lincoln, she completed full international baccalaureate, which is an international program which gave her full college credit. She graduated as valedictorian of her class. In the fall, she will be attending the University of Pennsylvania. She's a sports nut like Margaret Carter. She loves basketball, swimming, and she loves soccer, but technically, she loves all sports, just into sports. So, Mr. President, welcome to Talia. And my second guest, who's going to be my intern until the legislature is over, is another name that you recognize. His father visited us with the Trailblazers last week. Joey Isaac is the son of Jay Isaac, the Senior Vice President of Business Affairs with the Portland Trail Blazers. His mom is a local actor. Her name is Betty Moyer, and you've probably seen her around in lots of films that were done here in Oregon. Joey is a sophomore at the University of Oregon. He is currently majoring in communications and minoring in business. Please welcome Joey Isaac and Talia Goldberg to the legislature today, Mr. President. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator, and to both of you, thank you for coming today and for joining your Oregon State Capitol, and certainly an honor and privilege to have you with us today. Are there further courtesies? Remonstrances? Chair recognizes Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. President. I've been troubled over the last few days over some of the claims on House Bill 2009, known by some as health care reform, known to others as growing government. And what was interesting, one of the initial claims was that it would create 3,500 new jobs. And I tried to figure out how that was going to happen. The way it's happening, Mr. President, is, quite simply, we are growing government. And they're doing it in a rather unique way, because this new agency will have a lot of positions transferred from other agencies, and then those other agencies will have to create new positions to fill the holes that were created. Mr. President, it's troubling to me that at a time when we are increasing taxes, which will cost us jobs in the private sector, we are expanding government. But what's even more troubling, Mr. President, is the fact that there are people in this building in positions to make decisions who actually truly believe that the creation of a government job will stimulate the economy. What troubles me, Mr. President, is how people could be so misinformed on the way the economy actually works.
Thank you, Senator. Is there further remonstrances? Messages from the House.
Mr. President, I'm directed by the Speaker to inform that the House has passed House Bills 5011, 5012, 5021, 5028, 5048, 2167, 2222, 2223, 2442, Senate Bill 284, passed the following Senate bills as amended by the House, Senate Bill 76, and the Speaker has signed House Bill 3140.
Reports from conference committees. Reports from standing committees. In accordance with SR 8.55 sub 1, committee report summary number 123 was distributed to members June 12th, and 124 was distributed today. This information will be recorded in the journal and the status report. It is so ordered. Reports from special committees. Chair recognizes Senator Richard Devlin.
5 minutes. Thank you, Mr. President. Senate colleagues, Senate Democrats request a 15-minute caucus.
Thank you, Senator. Chair recognizes Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Mr. President. Likewise, Republicans will move directly to the caucus room from the floor for 15 minutes. Thank you, Mr. President.
A request for caucus has been made. We will take a recess until 10:15.
Senate will please come to order. The clerk will please call the roll.
Atkinson, Bates, Bonamici, Boquist, Burdick, Carter, Devlin, Dingfelder, Ferrioli, George, Gerard, Haas, Johnson, Cruz, Metzger, Monis Anderson, Monroe, Morissette, Morse, Nelson, Prozonsky, Rosenbaum, Schrader, Starr, Telfer, Berger, Walker, Whitsett, Winters, President Courtney.
A quorum is present. The Senate recess found the order of reports from special committees and will zoom under the proposition motion so ordered. We'll now recognize Senator Floyd Prozonsky, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move that the Senate refuse to concur in the House amendments to Senate Bill 274.
Senator Floyd Prozonsky moves that the Senate refuse to concur in the House amendments to Senate Bill 274. Please explain your motion.
Thank you, Mr. President. Basically, this is not a refusal of what they have put into the bill, but we realize that there is another addition that could be made, specifically in the area where the governor will have the appointment power for the chief administrative law judge. The bill currently reads that it would also have that individual serve at their pleasure. And speaking with the governor's staff, who spoke with the governor directly, he is willing to modify that language to have that person serve up for cause. So this will give a little more independence for the chief administrative law judge, so there's not the perception, at least, that he or she was potentially at risk for any type of decision that was made that a governor may think in the future was not to their liking. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you. Discussion? All those in favor of the motion signify saying aye, aye, and those opposed, no. The motion is carried. The Senate has refused to concur in the House amendments to Senate Bill 274. Recognize Senator Mark Haas.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate concur in House amendments and repass Senate Bill 344.
Senator Mark Haas moves that the Senate concur in the House amendments and repass Senate 344. To your motion, please.
Senate Bill 344, as it left the Senate, dealt with the appointment rather than the election of county surveyors. The House amendments add a specific exemption for Multnomah County Sheriff Bob Skipper to forego a four-month cadet training course. As many of you know, Sheriff Skipper has more than 30 years of experience, but due to his retirement 13 years ago, would have been required to complete basic training for new recruits in order to accept his appointment as Multnomah County Sheriff. Mr. President, this is the legislature's effort to restore some common sense into the system. Oregonians are grateful for Sheriff Skipper to come out of retirement to clean up that office, and I ask you to concur in House amendments to Senate Bill 344.
Thank you. Discussion. Those of you that opinion of the Senate should concur in the House amendments and repeat. Excuse me, Senator Laurie Montes Anderson. I don't.
Thank you, Mr. President. I want to speak to the amendment. We do not want to set a precedent in this case, and I wanted to put that on the record. But this is something that we need to do, just because we do not need to have someone of the caliber that Sheriff Bob Skipper has to have to go through basic training. He has brought respect, integrity, firm and consistent leadership in a department that was really indeed full of chaos when he came on board. It really makes sense. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you. Further discussion? Senator, Oh, recognized Senator Rob Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Mona Sanderson and I found out about the problem up in our county and initiated this effort to get this bill amended. Also, if somehow it had been impossible to amend Sheriff Skipper's information into this bill, I actually used one of my courtesy bills and had it ready as kind of a backup. The county of Multnomah has had some problems with governance. Our county commission was known a few years ago as the most dysfunctional government in Oregon. We now have some new leaders in county government, including our chair, Ted Wheeler. We also had a situation in the sheriff's office that was, well, calling it dysfunctional would be a compliment. And Ted Wheeler and others went to Bob Skipper and asked him to come out of retirement and to lead our county sheriff's department once again. We're proud of the fact that he did that. It was embarrassing to me as an official in the state, in the Multnomah County, to have the kind of dysfunctional county government and dysfunctional situation in the sheriff's office that we faced. I'm very proud and have known Bob Skipper for a long time, very proud of his work, and very proud of the fact that he agreed to come out of retirement, and was dismayed when he was facing the kind of training activity that you would expect for a rookie. And so he is right now undergoing a two-week updating program where he will be studying and learning about all of the law changes that have been made in the last 13 years while he was retired. This will be more than adequate to prepare him to continue to lead our county, the Sheriff's Department, and to work with our county government and bring us on to a level of respect that the citizens of Multnomah County come to expect. So I would urge aye on this concurrence and recognize that Sheriff Skipper is in the gallery up there in the corner. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussions? If not, the question now arises on third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 344C. Those who are of the opinion the Senate should concur in the House amendments and repass Senate Bill 344 will answer aye as their names are called. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll.
Telfer. Telfer. Berger. Walker. Whitsett. Winters. Atkinson. Bates. Bates, Bonamici, Boquist, Burdick, Burdick, Carter, Devlin, Dingfelder, Ferrioli, George, Girard, Hass, Johnson, Cruz, Metzger,
aye.
Montes Anderson, Monroe, Morissette, Morse, Nelson, Prozonsky, Rosenbaum, Schrader, Starr, President Courtney, not answering, Bates, absent, Bates, voting no, Ferrioli, Cruz, Winters, 25 ayes.
Senate Bill 344, having received a constitutional majority, is declared repassed. Chair recognizes Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. President. Colleagues, I move that the Senate concur in the House amendments and repass Senate Bill 780.
Senator Devlin has moved that the Senate concur in the House amendments and repass Senate Bill 780. To your motion.
Thank you, Mr. President. Colleagues, the House merely added a conflict amendment. We had earlier in this session passed Senate Bill 356, which dealt with the asset forfeiture. And the bill that we have before us is simply reducing the number of legislators on the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee from 6 to 4 that I believe overwhelmingly passed in this body. In fact, there were, I think, some of the legislators that are on it wanted to volunteer to be the two that would go off. So it's just a conflict amendment. Good bill should pass.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussion? There's no further discussion. The question rises on adopting the House amendments and concurring to repass Senate Bill 780. Those who are all in favor will answer aye as their names are called. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll.
Verger. Walker. Whitsett. Winters. Atkinson. Bates. Bonamici. Boquist. Burdick. Carter. Carter. Devlin. Dingfelder. Farioli. George. Gerard. Hass. Johnson. Cruz. Metzger. Monis Anderson. Monroe. Morissette. Morse. Nelson. Prozonsky. Rosenbaum. Schrader. Starr. Telfer. President Courtney. Absent Bates, 29 ayes.
Senate Bill 780, having received a constitutional majority, is declared repassed. Action on executive appointments requiring Senate confirmation. Introduction and first reading of Senate measures. Second reading of Senate measures.
Senate Bill 5532, relating to financial administration of the Department of Land Conservation and Development and declaring an emergency. Senate Bill 630, relating to disproportionality in child welfare, foster care, and declaring an emergency.
Pass the calendar. Third reading of Senate measures. The clerk will read the bill.
Senate Bill 5502, relating to financial administration of the State Department of Agriculture, appropriating money and declaring an emergency.
Chair recognizes Senator Margaret Carter. Senate Bill 5502.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senate Bill 5502 is the budget bill for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. The Department of Ag ensures food safety, protects agricultural natural resources, and promotes economic development in the agricultural industry. The budget for the department totals $87.4 million. The budget includes $14.4 million general fund and $10.4 million lottery funds, $50.2 million other funds, and $12.4 million federal funds. A total of nearly $3 million general fund was reduced from the essential budget level. Reductions included savings from suspending the pesticide use reporting system for the biennium. The budget includes cuts to support for predator control, pesticides, outreach and education, agricultural marketing, renewable energy projects, and confined animal feeding operations. Two agricultural water quality positions funded with ballot measure 66 lottery funds were also eliminated. Some of the department's programs that had been funded with general fund were instead supported with other funds, including the Pesticide Analytical Response Center, a farm mediation position, and a renewable energy technical assistance position. Other funds expenditure limitation was added for fee increases in the brand inspection and nursery programs, as well as to purchase new lab equipment and fund two limited duration pesticide investigators. $5.3 million federal funds were added for specialty crop grants and other recent experience with higher levels of federal funding. The Joint Committee on Ways and Means recommends approval of Senate Bill 5502 as amended. And just an editorial point, Mr. President, this is an agency that is very well disciplined and very well run. You can believe that even though there are fees in this budget, that there are fees that she has worked very hard with interest groups to get them engaged in being able to keep this program, this agency, on track with not only federal regulations, but with regulations of this state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussion. Chair recognizes Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the good senator from North Portland, Northeast Portland, just said it exactly right. This agency is so well run. Out of all the budgets that we had on our Natural Resources Subcommittee, they were on task, on time, on budget, to paraphrase my colleague on the other side of the aisle. But they were responsive to every single question we had. Their budget presentation was incredible, responsive to Oregonians and food safety. I can't say enough about this budget. The Department of Agriculture is very well run. You should be proud of this agency. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussion? Not the question now arises on third reading, final passage of Senate Bill 5502. Those who are of the opinion the bill should pass will answer aye as their names are called. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll.
Walker. Whitsett. Whitsett. Winters. Atkinson. Bates, Bonamici, Boquist, Boquist, Burdick, Carter, Devlin, Dingfelder, Ferrioli, George, Girard, Haas, Johnson, John, Cruz, Metzger, Montes Anderson, Monroe, Morset, Morse, Nelson, Przonski, Rosenbaum, Schrader, Starr, Telfer, Verger, President Courtney, absent, Bates, voting no, Atkinson, Boquist, George, 26 ayes.
Senate Bill 5502, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
Senate Bill 5503, relating to financial administration of the State Department of Agriculture and declaring an emergency.
Chair recognizes Senator Margaret Carter again on Senate Bill 5503.
I'm sorry, Mr. President. I was filling in. These are actually Senator Nelson's bills that were supposed to come up on Friday, so I forgot I was doing this today. My apologies. Senate Bill 5503 ratifies fee modifications implemented through the rulemaking during the 2007-09 interim. Fees were modified for Christmas tree license, nursery licenses, and livestock brand inspections. The revenue from these fees is assumed in the budget for the Department of Agriculture. The Joint Committee on Ways and Means recommends approval of Senate Bill 5503 as amended.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussion? Not the question now rises on third reading, final passage of Senate Bill 5503. Those who are of the opinion the bill should pass will answer ayes or names are called. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll.
Whitsett. Whitsett. Winters. Winters. Atkinson. Bates. Bonamici. Boquist. Boquist. Burdick, Carter, Devlin, Dingfelder, Ferrioli, George, Girard, Haas, Johnson, Cruz, Metzger, Montes Anderson, Monroe, Morset, Morse, Nelson, Przonski, Przonski, Rosenbaum, Schrader, Starr, Telfer, Verger, Walker, President Courtney, absent, Bates, voting no, Atkinson, Boquist, Ferrioli, George, Girard, Cruz, Starr, Telfer, 21 ayes.
Senate Bill 5503, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
Senate Bill 5512, relating to financial administration of the Construction Contractors Board and declaring an emergency.
Chair recognizes Senator Schrader.
Good morning, colleagues. Senate Bill 5512 is the budget bill for the Construction Contractors Board. The board regulates the profession of construction contracting through licensing and disciplinary programs. The board provides dispute resolution services, investigates complaints, and imposes fines for the violations of Oregon laws. The agency is primarily funded with revenue generated from license fees. The Joint Committee on Ways and Means approved an other funds budget of $15,526,404 and 79 positions, 75.5 full-time equivalent. The budget is 1.8% less than the 07-09 legislatively approved budget. The Construction Contractors Board has seen revenues drop dramatically as the economy has been hit very hard. The agency proposed raising fees. We did not approve this request. The committee approved a potential fee increase from $260 to $325. However, that fee increase will be delayed until July of 2010. The committee also approved continuing all positions included in the essential budget level for the first year of the 09-11 biennium. It did not approve seven positions. These seven positions could potentially be eliminated for the second year of the biennium. If revenues do improve, the agency may return to the emergency board and request that some or all of the positions be continued for the remainder of the biennium. The agency's performance measures were reviewed and approved with one revised target. The Joint Committee on Ways and Means recommends approval of Senate Bill 5512-8.
Thank you, Senator. Chair recognizes Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm going to vote against this budget, not because of the good work that occurred in the subcommittee, but because I've heard from numerous small contractors that are inordinately frustrated with the CCB. And in their words, in their frame of mind, the CCB is catering to the larger contractors and ignoring small contractors. And while the fee has been negotiated in this bill to accommodate kind of the economy, when you look at especially the small contractors, and I'm talking about the one-man shops, the guy that is out there with a truck that's doing minor home repair, that has to accommodate these fees. But it's not just the fee particularly, but it's also the attitude within the agency in dealing specifically with small contractors. So I think overall this agency is well run. But I'm going to vote no as a mini protest urging the agency to work not only with the larger contractors and the large home builders, but also with an eye toward those one-man shops that are out there working hard to try to make ends meet in this economy. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you, Senator. Chair recognizes Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I rise in support of Senate Bill 5512. The committee listened to a lot of reasons that this agency exists, but also, more importantly, the industry itself came and recommended an increase that we would not approve. And that was a fee increase up to $410. We did not think that was appropriate given the economic situation and given that there are small independent operators. So we actually reduced their request plus delayed the request, hoping that when the economy turns, that then they may be able to afford it. We also, in the committee, did not actually honor their request of seven positions. We, by the time we completed with the work of this particular agency, I believe that it's one where, one, they did not get what they asked for, either by the agency or by the professional industry itself, and two, that the position to carry out the agencies was also reduced, and I would ask your aye vote.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussion? Not Senator Schrader. Do you wish to close? She does not. The question now arises on third reading, final passage of Senate Bill 5512. Those who are of the opinion the bill should pass will answer aye as their names are called. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll.
Winters. Atkinson. Ates. Bonamici. Boquist. Burdick. Carter. Devlin. Dingfelder. Farioli. George. Gerard, Haas, Johnson, Cruz, Metzger, Montesanderson, Monroe, Morissette, Morse, Nelson, Prozonsky, Rosenbaum, Schrader, Starr, Telfer, Verger, Walker, Whitsett, President Courtney. Absent, Bates. Voting no, Atkinson, Boquist, Farioli, George, Gerard, Cruz, Starr, Telfer, Whitsett. 20 ayes.
Senate Bill 5512, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. First reading of House measures.
House Bill 5011 relating to financial administration of the Employment Relations Board, appropriating money and declaring an emergency. House Bill 5012 relating to financial administration of the Employment Relations Board and declaring an emergency. House Bill 5021 relating to financial administration of the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability, appropriating money and declaring an emergency. House Bill 5028 relating to financial administration of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, appropriating money and declaring an emergency. House Bill 5048 relating to financial administration of the Department of Veterans Affairs, appropriating money and declaring an emergency. House Bill 2167 relating to distribution of 911 taxes. House Bill 2222 relating to State Department of Fish and Wildlife and prescribing an effective date. House Bill 2223 relating to State Department of Fish and Wildlife fees and appropriating money. House Bill 2442 relating to care providers, appropriating money and declaring an emergency.
Transmitted to the President's desk for referral. Second reading of House measures.
House Joint Resolution 7, proposing amendment to Oregon Constitution relating to eligibility to receive loan from Oregon War Veterans Fund. House Bill 5002 relating to financial administration of the Oregon Department of Administrative Services, appropriating money and declaring an emergency. House Bill 2004 relating to checkoff on income tax returns for political contributions and prescribing an effective date. House Bill 2227 relating to destination resorts. House Bill 2533 relating to school finance and prescribing an effective date. House Bill 2802 relating to non-economic damages and prescribing an effective date. House Bill 3232 relating to Oregon Health Licensing Agency.
Pass to calendar. Third reading of House measures, House Bill 2672 will be placed at the foot of today's calendar. The clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2941 relating to ballot titles and declaring an emergency.
Chair recognizes Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. President. House Bill 2941A changes provisions on ballot titles that are drafted by the Attorney General for initiative petitions. Current law provides that to avoid confusion, a ballot title shall not resemble any title previously filed for a measure to be submitted at the election. This provision encourages initiative petition sponsors to submit more than one substantially similar measures for title drafting. These sponsors are then able to select from among different titles drafted by the Attorney General. This is called ballot title shopping, and of course it's aimed at getting the best ballot title for success at the polls. House Bill 2941A stops the practice of ballot title shopping. House Bill 2941A requires the Attorney General to provide identical draft ballot titles for state measures if the Attorney General determines that subject, purpose, and major effect of two or more state measures are substantially similar. House Bill 2941A eliminates the current requirement that ballot titles not resemble any title previously filed for a measure to be submitted at that election. Colleagues, ballot title shopping can cost us hundreds of thousands of dollars from the Attorney General and Secretary of State's budget. It's been used to manipulate our initiative system, and 2941 will end the practice of ballot title shopping. I urge an aye vote.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussion? Now the question arises on third reading, final passage of House Bill 2941. Those who are of the opinion the bill should pass will answer aye as their names are called. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll.
Atkinson.
No.
Bates. Bonamici.
Aye.
Boquist.
No.
Burdick.
Aye.
Carter.
Aye.
Devlin.
Aye.
Dingfelder. Ferrioli,
no.
George,
no.
Girard, Haas, Johnson,
aye.
Cruz, Metzger,
aye.
Montes Anderson, Monroe,
aye.
Morissette,
aye.
Morse,
aye.
Nelson,
aye.
Przonski,
aye.
Rosenbaum,
aye.
Schrader,
aye.
Starr,
no.
Telfer,
no.
Verger,
aye.
Walker,
aye.
Whitsett,
aye.
Winters, President Courtney. President Courtney. Absent, Bates, voting no, Atkinson, Boquist, Ferrioli, George, Girard, Cruz, Starr, Telfer, Whitsett, Winters. 19 ayes.
House Bill 2941, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2005, relating to election petitions and declaring an emergency.
Chair recognizes Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. President. House Bill 2005 comes to you from your Senate Rules Committee at the request of the Secretary of State. House Bill 2005 builds on the work done by the 2007 legislature to enact laws that will help restore confidence in the fairness and integrity of the initiative and referendum process in Oregon. It fine-tunes that legislation to close some loopholes, improve accountability, and provide the Secretary of State's office with more effective enforcement tools. In 2000, 2, Oregon voters enacted Measure 26, which is now part of Article 4, Section 1B of the Oregon Constitution, and this is a ban on the practice of pay per signature. The constitutionality of that initiative was upheld by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals noted that Oregon citizens had a right to regulate the process of gathering initiatives so long as the regulations did not target the communicative aspect of signature gathering. Since Measure 26 passed, the challenge has been its enforcement. In Section 2, Sub 9, House Bill 2005 gives the Secretary of State the tools needed to enforce Measure 26 by prohibiting a registered signature gatherer from collecting signatures on a petition for which he/she is being paid, and at the same time obtaining signatures on a petition or prospective petition on a volunteer basis. The bill extends the requirements relating to paid circulators to the collection of the 1,000 sponsorship signatures required to file a prospective petition and receive a ballot title. One section of this bill has gotten more attention than others. It amends ORS 260.561 to make it clear that chief petitioners have a responsibility to oversee the signature collection process and to report any unlawful conduct. It does so by making the chief petitioner liable for certain violations committed by circulators where the chief petitioner knew or should have known about the misconduct and failed to report that conduct to the Secretary of State. This provision is necessary in order to make the process as self-enforcing as possible. In the past, chief petitioners delegated responsibility for gathering signatures to others, and then when problems arose, claimed that that's not my fault. Just as employers are responsible for the conduct of those performing their work, chief petitioners should be responsible for the conduct of those collecting signatures on their behalf. In this vein, House Bill 2005 also provides that chief petitioners have a heightened duty to oversee and report unlawful conduct in the signature gathering process because of their key role in the initiative and referendum process. Moreover, by making these reports, they avoid liability. Section 6 of the bill amends ORS 260.563 in a similar manner as Section 5 to make contractors liable for circulator misconduct where they knew or should have known of the conduct and failed to make a report. The criminal liability under these sections is limited to specific statutes. There must be independent evidence to hold chief petitioners and contractors criminally liable for the criminal acts of their signature gatherers. Colleagues, by enacting these simple and straightforward reforms, we can hold all who participate in Oregon's initiative system to the highest of standards and reduce the gaming of our system. With the passage of this bill, we will start down the difficult road of restoring confidence in the initiative system, which was once called the Oregon system. House Bill 2005 lets Oregonians know that the initiatives on the ballot are there legally and legitimately. Thank you, and I recommend passage of House Bill 2005.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussion? Chair recognizes Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. President. Colleagues, I want to make it clear that personally I would never support a bill which did anything to take away the people's right to the initiative process. In fact, I have served as a chief petitioner myself and worked hard on more than one initiative campaign. But I think it's very clear that House Bill 2005 is needed. It builds on a bill that we passed last session, House Bill 2182, that attempted to eliminate fraud, forgery, and many other abuses of the initiative process. But in fact, in the last election cycle, we saw some of the worst abuses of that process that we have seen since its inception. Having looked at some of the signature sheets that were turned in, you could see clearly that sheets had been placed with carbon paper in between so that signatures were identical from one sheet to the next, or that chief petitioners had signed these sheets in completely different handwritings for the same person.
So this bill simply attempts to provide the training, the background checks, and other protections for enforcement of these provisions that are needed to clean up this process. Far from crippling the process, this will actually restore integrity to that process, which is an important part of our government, and I urge your support.
Thank you, Senator. Chair recognizes Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, or Mr. President. I rise in opposition to this bill. It's just one of a pattern, like the previous bill, that seeks to abridge, deflect, eliminate, or otherwise interfere with the initiative process. This one is particularly bizarre because a volunteer who's obtaining signatures for a petition could not also be a paid petition gatherer. I don't know what that provision is aimed at exactly. Perhaps in the close we'll find out. But the bottom line is that raising the bar, making it more difficult, adding training requirements, adding certifications, publishing the names of people on the Internet who've signed petitions, requiring fingerprints and background checks and all of the impedimenta that can be thought of has been the objective of the Secretary of State and others who simply do not like the outcome of the initiative petition process. You know, if you don't like the outcome, use procedures and use process to make the gathering of petitions so difficult as to nearly be impossible. Colleagues, the citizens of the state of Oregon reserved unto themselves the right to engage in a petition process. It's full contact democracy. It's direct democracy. And there is litigation currently before the Supreme Court in Oregon that may result in a decision that the legislature has no business and no right to restrict or place impediments before the initiative process that would discourage the citizens from the free exercise of the franchise they created for themselves in the Constitution. Mr. President, I've seen many of these bills. There's probably a number more coming. Let's not kid anybody. This is about not liking the outcome of the citizens' initiative process. I'm a no. I hope those that feel as I do will join me in voting no, and I hope at some point the citizens take note of just who it is that is trying to impede and restrict their access to the initiative process. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you, Senator. Chair recognizes Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. President. I stand up in opposition to this bill. It's really, really frustrating to come to the legislature and have folks move bills like this. I mean, the underlying philosophical reason, I guess, for doing this is that somehow, some way, the initiative system is broken or doesn't work. So the reality is it's quite the opposite. It is a vehicle whereby Oregonians can basically petition their government. And for us to stand, sit, work here in this legislative process in the legislature to make it more difficult really, really, really frustrates me because the initiative system is not broke. This initiative system works fairly well. What we're doing with this bill is just making it more and more difficult for the average Oregonian who would like to take an issue and present it before in front of his neighbors, fellow Oregonians, basically makes it impossible. Is this going to make the initiative system obsolete or go away? No, it's not. But what it will do is make it much more difficult and much more expensive. And who then has access to it? Who then will have access to the initiative system? Only those that have the resources. Only those that have lots and lots of money. That's what we're doing, making the initiative system even more expensive so that average Oregonians will not be able to go out and have a great idea, motivate grassroots, motivate their fellow neighbors, get an idea in front of Oregon voters. You'll only be able to do that if you have millions of dollars. And believe you me, there are folks that will have the resources to do it. But it cuts out the vast majority of Oregonians. And I think it's a bad idea, and I urge a no vote.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussion. Chair recognizes Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually agree with the good senator from Hillsborough. I don't think this bill is a good idea. If I was a person out there, a regular Oregonian, trying to get something changed in state law, and I wanted to circulate a petition, it would scare the heebie-jeebies out of me to look at Section 11 in this bill that says now all of a sudden instead of a $250 violation, we're going to slap you with a $10,000 violation for any number of violations. This is ridiculous. I believe in making Oregon's initiative system fair and just, and we have to cut down on the number of them, but my goodness, we're just really going to stop all those except well-financed interest groups from being able to do it, because who's going to indemnify you if you don't have a lot of money behind you? So this 40-fold increase in the fine is outrageous in my view. In fact, some of the fines that the Secretary of State's office imposes upon us for mere little bookkeeping errors is ridiculous. And I would tell you also that the monthly turn-in of signature sheets, while that sounds like a good idea because I actually think that we need better verification of signatures, testimony was on the record that they don't plan, the Secretary of State's office doesn't plan on checking the signatures as they're turned in. They're not going to do it until they meet the threshold. So why are you making those signature sheets available to the public until you have reached that threshold and reviewed them? This is senseless. This is putting people out there to be harassed by those who want to call them up and say, why did you sign that petition? I just think we are getting out of control here with trying to rein in the initiative process. And I am a strong, absolutely strong no on this bill today. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussion? Senator Burdick, do you wish to close?
Thank you, Mr. President. Just briefly, as a former chief petitioner myself, like my good colleague from District 21, I'm absolutely comfortable with the fact that this would not have harmed me in any way during that petition gathering effort, and it wouldn't now. For one thing, a lot of these requirements that apply to paid petition signers, paid petition gatherers, do not apply to volunteers, the background checks, the training, those types of things. So any citizen with a good cause can go out and round up their grassroots network and get them out in the streets, and there still occasionally are petitions that get on the ballot with all volunteers. Colleagues, we would not have House Bill 2005 before us today if there had not been serious, serious abuses of Oregon's initiative process over the past couple of decades. The initiative process has become the playground for well-funded special interests that come into Oregon with a specific agenda and a lot of money. And they put these things on the ballot, and we've had case after case after case where fraud is committed, criminal activity is committed, and House Bill 2005 is a way of addressing those problems. It would not be necessary if those problems were not existing. So this is a good bill. We need to assure Oregonians that there is integrity in their initiative process. And when an Oregonian signs a petition, they have to know that that's being done legally, that that's being done appropriately, and that they are going to have a chance to vote on an initiative on the ballot that got there honestly and legally without fraud or criminal activity. I urge an aye vote on House Bill 2005.
Question now rises on third reading, final passage of House Bill 2005. Those who are of the opinion the bill should pass will answer aye. Your names are called. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call a roll.
Bates. Bonamici. Boquist. Burdick. Carter. Devlin. Dingfelder. Farioli. George. Girard. Hass. Johnson. Cruz. Metzger. Montes Anderson. Monroe. Morissette. Morse. Nelson. Przonsky. Rosenbaum. Schrader. Starr. Telfer. Ferger. Walker. Whitsett. Winters. Atkinson. President Courtney. Voting no. Atkinson. Boquist. Voting no. Atkinson, Boquist, Farioli, George, Girard, Cruz, Morse, Nelson, Starr, Walker, Whitsett, Winters. 18 ayes.
House Bill 2005, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Senator George, for what purpose do you rise?
Vote explanation, Mr. President.
Please proceed.
Mr. President, I oppose the bill for a number of reasons, but one of the biggest reasons I oppose the bill was the clause in there that would make you criminal, make the chief petitioner criminally liable for the activities of a volunteer. I went down to Secretary of State Brown's office and met with her, and I thought she was very fair-minded and objective about taking my concerns. And my understanding is that she is going to urge the legislature to fix that problem in another bill. And I just wanted to compliment the secretary for being willing to meet with me, since she knows we're philosophically opposed, and being objective in her consideration of my objections to this particular bill. And I'm urging the legislature to pass the bill that she's going to correct that problem in this particular bill. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you, Senator. Okay, we'll now return to the normal order of business on third reading, and we will go back to the bill that we skipped over, House Bill 2672, and the clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 2672, relating to distribution of tobacco products, appropriating money, prescribing effective date, and providing for revenue raising that requires approval by 3/5 majority.
Chair recognizes Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. President. Colleagues, I'll first apologize for being a little late this morning. When you're going through Grants Pass and you realize you left your wallet at home, you do the right thing. You turn around and go back. So I'm about an hour late getting here, and I do apologize. And I also apologize for this bill being about 3 months late, but we're going to run it this morning, and let's get it done. This is House Bill 2672B. Smokeless tobacco was a fast-growing segment of the tobacco industry. New laws banning smoking in the workplace and bars and restaurants make smokeless tobacco attractive to consumers, and has led to a new marketing effort by the industry to attract new customers, especially young consumers. Make no mistake, smokeless tobacco is not without risk, because it's simply smoke-free. It increases the risk of cancer of the lip, tongue, cheeks, gum, and the floor of the roof of the mouth, including bladder cancer and colon cancer. It is not a safe alternative to smoking. House Bill 2672 establishes a minimum tax to be applied equally to all smokeless tobacco products sold in Oregon. It closes a loophole in our current tax policy that encourages the sale of tobacco products at shockingly low retail prices. This type of promotion poses a unique and dangerous enticement to Oregon's youth, and it is something that we as policymakers should do what we can to stop. Oregon is one of the three states at the top of R.J. Reynolds' tobacco's list for launching campaigns to capture a new generation of addicts. These gateway products are designed to use novel flavor and delivery systems. They look and taste like candy, to introduce young people to nicotine use and ultimately lead them to cigarettes. Nicotine in any form is a highly addictive substance, one of the most addictive substances we know in medicine, and in any way you get it can addict you to it and will addict you to it. Today, smokeless tobacco is taxed at an ad valorem basis. As a result, very little tax is paid on the cheapest products, which are most accessible to youth. Retail prices vary across the state, but many smokeless tobacco products can be found at prices of less than a dollar. New smokeless tobacco products such as snus, camel sticks, and orbs, like the ones in your desk, which I was going to lay out for you, didn't do this morning, I'm sorry, have been introduced to the market with campaigns that liken the product to candy and target a very young consumer group. Under House Bill 2672, moist snuff will be taxed by weight at $1.78 per ounce, with a minimum floor of $2.14 for any retail product, which will increase revenue by $5.5 million for the 2009-11 biennium. Also, House Bill 2672 contains an indexing feature that links the uniform tax to the consumer price index in future years, guaranteeing that the tax will continue to increase along with inflation. House Bill 2672 also contains the following three components. One, it establishes a new reporting and registration requirement for moist snuff products. The sale of unreported products is prohibited. The Department of Justice plans to augment their current registration and reporting system for combustible tobacco products, such as cigarettes, to meet new requirements in the bill for smokeless tobacco products. Two, it creates an incentive for all non-participating manufacturers to comply with youth marketing restrictions and the smokeless tobacco settlement agreement by requiring that they either voluntarily comply with the provisions of the agreement or pay into an escrow account until they cease youth marketing practices. And three, it bans distribution of free samples of smokeless tobacco products to individuals under the age of 21 or in locations that are not restricted to people over the age of 21. The bill provides for penalties for noncompliance with this provision. This bill is an important public health initiative which will reduce youth access to smokeless tobacco products and reduce the growth of these in the market in Oregon. It is supported by the Tobacco Free Coalition, the American Lung Association, the American Cancer Society, and a variety of other anti-tobacco and public health organizations. It is also supported by the U.S. Tobacco. If you are skeptical about the incentives created by our current smokeless tobacco policy, promoting tobacco and creating market share, let me leave you with a snapshot of what has happened here in Oregon in the last several years. In 2001, tobacco companies in Oregon started selling chewing tobacco for 49 cents a can. They started with zero market share for this new, extraordinarily inexpensive product. By end of last year, 2008, these same ultra-cheap, low-tax products accounted for 50% of the moist snuff market. If you think that experience is lost in these companies as they consider how to push their new candy products of tobacco, don't be surprised you see 0.25 cent tobacco mints the next time you stop at your local mini-mart. House Bill 2762 is important and timely, and I urge your aye vote. Just for a quick visual, these are the packets they come in. They look like a small cell phone. You can pop them out, these little pellets come out, and I taste the one, they taste like candy. And you put them in your lip, and away you go. So I would ask for your aye vote on this important bill. Thank you.
Thank you. We're now in discussion. Recognize Senator Lori Montes Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. President. This is a long overdue tax on smokeless tobacco. It is going to help prevent kids from becoming addicted to another dangerous product. We are passing all over the country indoor clean air laws, and therefore the tobacco companies are pushing smokeless tobacco products. Tobacco use in Oregon is responsible for 22% of all deaths in Oregon. More than car accidents, more than alcohol abuse, illegal drug use, and violent crime combined, all those combined. Tobacco use costs Oregonians more than $2 billion in health care costs and lost productivity due to premature death every year. That's $600 per every household in Oregon. And also, kids are less likely to try tobacco products when the retail price is high. Let's help protect Oregon kids. Vote yes. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you. We're now in discussion. Senator Bates, do you wish to close? He does not. Senator Richard Devlin is demanding a call of the Senate. He's joined by Senator Dianne Rosenbaum and by Senator Lori Montes Anderson. The doorkeepers will bar the doors, and Sergeant Barnes will attend. The clerk will call the roll.
Atkinson. Bates. Bonamici, Boquist, Burdick, Carter, Devlin, Dingfelder, Ferrioli, George, Girard, Pass, Johnson, Cruz, Metzger, Montes Anderson, Monroe, Morissette, Morse, Nelson, Prozonsky, Rosenbaum, Schrader, Starr, Telfer, Berger, Walker, Whitsett, Winters, President Courtney.
Yes.
All present.
All those subjects to call are present. The question now rises upon a third reading, the final passage. I'm waiting for the court. On House Bill 2672, All those in the opinion bill is passed, say aye. Those opposed, no. Clerk, please call the roll.
Bonamici. Yeah. Boquist. Burdick. Carter. Devlin. Dingfelder. Ferrioli. George. Girard. Hass. Johnson. Cruz. Metzger. Moss Anderson. Monroe. Morissette. Morse. Nelson. Prezonsky. Rosenbaum. Schrader. Starr. Telfer. Ferger. Walker. Whitsett. Winters. Atkinson. Bates. President Courtney.
Yes.
Voting no. Boquist, Ferrioli, George, Girard, Cruz, Nelson, Telfer, Whitsett, Winters. 21 ayes.
House Bill 2672, having received the constant majority, is declared passed. Court reads bill.
House Bill 2194, related to Oregon Medical Insurance Pool.
Recognize Senator Lori Montes Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. President. This is actually a housekeeping bill for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. The Oregon Medical Insurance Pool is the state's high-risk health insurance pool. It provides coverage to Oregonians unable to obtain commercial medical insurance because of pre-existing health conditions. And to those eligible for portability coverage who have no access to commercial Oregon portability plans. I'll cite an example, colleagues. A constituent of mine needed a second transplant, a liver transplant, and was unable, didn't have health insurance because her health insurance wouldn't cover her second implant. And this was a really, her first implant was actually not a good liver. And so what her church did was pay the premiums for OMIP, and she was able to get her second transplant, and she is doing well just because of this program. Basically, the changes that it makes, it replaces the OMIP definition of medical insurance. It allows a majority of voting board members to present to take action. It clarifies limits on payment of enrollee premiums by public entities or health care providers, and it modifies some of the eligibility to conform to federal law. It's a good bill. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you. Recognize Senator Frank Morris.
Thank you, Mr. President. Colleagues, this bill is worthy of your support, but there are issues surrounding OMIP that are not worthy of your support, and it has to do with how OMIP is funded. And if you would indulge me, Mr. President, and allow me to address that issue.
Yes, please proceed, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. President. Colleagues, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool is essential to Oregon. Make no mistake about it. Currently, there are 15,100 people insured through OMIP. These folks are uninsurable under normal health coverage due to their current illnesses or existing conditions. And their premium currently is set at 115% of the current market for similar coverage. However, the medical expenses for these folks exceeds the premiums paid, and the difference is picked up through an assessment on commercial insurance carriers. OMIP works very well, and most importantly, it is a zero-cost item to the state of Oregon. Currently, the assessment applies to only those employers in Oregon who insure their employees through a commercial insurance carrier. This represents 70% of the workforce, mostly small companies and individual plans. And herein, colleagues, lies the problem. Most employers do not understand the complicated issue of funding OMIP, but they do understand the principle of fairness. If OMIP is good for Oregon, then all Oregon employers should be asked to contribute to its funding, not just small employers. Herein lies the problem. More than 30% of employees in Oregon are covered by self-funded plans. Allowing self-funded plans and the Taft-Hartley Health and Welfare Trust to escape this assessment, colleagues, is patently unfair, and it is a poor way to create a sustainable assessment base because it is not broad-based. Asking only fully insured employers to bear the entire burden of paying for OMIP is clearly not equitable because it allows self-funded large employers and the Taft-Hartley Health and Welfare Trust to avoid paying the assessment. But understand this, colleagues, yet their employees all benefit from the OMIP portability option. Now, please think about this situation. If you are an employee at one of Oregon's largest companies that is totally self-insured, or an employee in a union company that insures through a Taft-Hartley Health and Welfare Trust, and you incur an illness that causes you to leave work and will leave you uninsurable, what happens? Okay, there are a couple of options here. You have the option of enrolling in COBRA, extending the coverage. But then once that expires, what happens next? Either you have no insurance or you enroll in the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. And who helps pay OMIP to insure the uninsurable? Is it Oregon's largest companies who have the resources to be totally self-insured? No, it is not. Is it the union companies who insure through the union health trusts? No, it is not. The cost of providing insurance for the uninsurable falls to the small and mid-sized companies who insure through fully insured indemnity plans or the self-insured who manage their risk by purchasing stop-loss insurance. Now, how do employees from the large, totally self-insured companies and Taft-Hartley plan members benefit from OMIP? Well, there are three ways, friends. Number one, it serves as a safety net for individuals with pre-existing health conditions that have applied and been turned down for individual coverage by an insurance carrier. Now, bear in mind, these are all employees, even employees of the trusts and the totally self-insured. Number two, OMIP is the only portability option for individuals who have exhausted their COBRA coverage through a self-funded plan or a Taft-Hartley Health and Welfare Trust. And three, without OMIP, these individuals would be unable to acquire any health insurance coverage. Insurance brokers routinely take phone calls from these individuals. Many have serious health conditions that disqualify them from purchasing coverage. And just for your information, agents do not get wealthy on these premiums. They earn an administrative fee of $75 for assisting with OMIP enrollment. The only problem facing OMIP is that the assessment is placed on too narrow a base. The solution is obvious. We simply need to expand and broaden the assessment base to include all Oregon employers, including large self-funded plans and Taft-Hartley trusts. The burden to fund OMIP is falling on fewer and fewer companies who purchase commercial insurance. And now I'd like to share with you some information specific. In 2007, commercial enrollment declined 10%, which had the effect of increasing premiums by 3.6%. With the economic crisis of today, that number will increase even more. What we are doing is disproportionately increasing the cost to the small and mid-sized businesses who offer commercial insurance by a tune of $24 per member per year. The OMIP assessment paid by Oregon employers who insure through insurance companies is presently $54 per employee per year. It will increase approximately $4.50 per member per month to $6.50, a 44% increase to a total of $78 per employee per year, all while the largest self-insured companies in the Taft-Hartley Trust pay zero, colleagues. This is an issue of equity. It's an issue of fairness. It's an issue of sustainability. And, Mr. President and colleagues, if this is an issue that we do not address in the future, we will have an OMIP plan that is not sustainable. So I very much appreciate the opportunity to bring this to the attention of the body, Mr. President. I realize that this is an issue that in some cases is too hot to handle, but if we don't address it, we have a problem that will carry forward into the future and will jeopardize this extremely valuable service that we offer to the uninsurables of Oregon. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you. I recognize Senator Jeff Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. President, and thank you for allowing us some latitude here. to do what we would have done in the minority report if situations had been different. And keep in mind, the same as the previous speaker, I do support the underlying bill, but we think it was important to get on the record this bigger issue, and an issue that the legislature can, in my opinion, no longer afford to ignore. Colleagues, union and third-party administrators cite four reasons why they should not have to contribute to OMIP. Let me tell you what they are. They say that in self-insured plans and union trusts, they're already doing the right thing. They are in part, but so is everyone else who purchases commercial insurance. They are doing the right thing too. But those with commercial insurance are also contributing to public good by helping to fund the high-risk pool. And under what would have been the minority report, everyone who purchases health insurance, no matter how you buy it or who you buy it from, would have contributed. Point two, they say small TPAs can't afford it. They say it will be a hardship on some third-party administrators and might even put some of them out of business. The reality of it is that the TPAs do not pay this assessment out of their profits any more than insurance companies now pay it out of their profits. The OMIP assessment is like a tax that is added to the premium. The insurance companies collect it, but it's the individual who buys the policy who pays it, and it's built into their premium. Point three was that they say it doesn't comply with ERISA. The unions have argued that federal law preempts this issue and they will sue if the bill passes. The OMIP board says their legal counsel believes they are on solid footing with the proposal. Two other states, Tennessee and Mississippi, have similar assessments and have had no ERISA challenges. In the 1990s, Safeco sued OMIP under ERISA, saying the assessment on stop-loss coverage was preempted. OMIP won in both state and federal court on that issue. Point four. Philosophically, the debate should be about who pays the OMIP assessment. And it was the same debate we had on the claims tax versus the premium tax earlier in the session. The unions and self-insured plans got a free ride on the proposed premium tax. They can certainly afford to kick in the $4.50 a month PMPM for OMIP, just like all other small employers do. One thing to consider, lower cost, healthier groups tend to leave the commercial market for self-insurance or association plans, leaving less healthy groups who can't leave the commercial market to bear the higher cost. To a degree, it is a self-selected system. It also need to keep in mind that these are higher costs mandated specifically on those in the private market who are in struggling to try to maintain insurance on their employees and for themselves individually. Colleagues, when you look at what we are doing this session, both for the OMIP assessment, the premium tax, and Lord knows how many mandates we'll have passed by the end of the session, which, by the way, will take the total number of mandates on insurance in the state of Oregon to over 40, we are creating a problem, and at some point in time, we as a legislative assembly need to deal with it and deal with it in the right way. We need to expand who we are assessing to make this plan work. Colleagues, if we had done this expansion, the OMIP assessment on the private sector would have stayed basically where it was, because the expanded population would have made up the necessary increase in the assessment. As I've said, the underlying bill is a good bill. It's a technical fix. And, Mr. President, thank you for having the opportunity to put on the record what I think should be an issue that is brought up in the February session of the legislature.
Thank you. Senator Brian Boquist yielded his time to Senator Frank Morris. Further discussion? Senator Laura Marzanis, you wish to close.
Yes.
I want to thank my good senators from southwestern Oregon and from Lynn Benton counties for bringing up this issue. It's an issue that is not going to go away because the market share of the commercial and individual, well, the individual and commercial market is decreasing. And therefore, there are more self-insured is happening and more, and then of course the union or the Taft-Hartley Trust have not been affected. But we didn't address it this time, but I feel it will be addressed in the future. But we don't want litigation right now, and there would be an ERISA challenge. And ERISA, everybody, is ERISA governs the Employee Welfare Benefit Plan. And its purpose is actually to ensure that the administrative practices of a benefit plan will be governed by only a single set of regulations. We, at this point in time, are just, I don't think, want to go through a litigation process. That will just increase costs for everyone involved. Also, because we're in the middle of health care reform, I do believe that this will be taken up in the future. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you. The question now arises upon the third reading, the final passage of House Bill 2194. Those in opinion bills to pass, say aye. Those opposed, no. Clerk, please call the roll.
Boquist. Burdick. Carter. Devlin. Devlin. Dingfelder. Farioli. George. Gerard. Hass. Johnson. Cruz. Metzger. Montes Anderson, Monroe, Morissette, Morse, Nelson, Pozanski, Rosenbaum, Schrader, Starr, Telfer, Verger, Walker, Whitsett, Winters, Atkinson, Bates, Bonamici. Bonamici. President Courtney.
Yes.
Not answering. Burdick. 30 ayes.
House Bill 2194. I received the constant majority as declared passed. Clerk reads bill.
House Bill 2682 relating to commercial security release and declaring an emergency.
Recognized Senator Floyd presents.
Thank you, Mr. President. House Bill 2682B came out of your Rules Committee on a 4-1 vote. What this bill basically does is it directs the joint Legislative Interim Committee on Judiciary to look at the possibility of bringing back to our state a surety bond system that we used to have some years back. This is just basically setting a course in motion to allow us to look at this. I've already told the stakeholders that we would be doing so anyway, but we now have a bill that will give us some guidance. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you. Recognize Senator Vicki Walker.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm just perplexed as to why we need a bill to tell an interim committee what to study or do in the interim. So I'm a no. This sets a bad precedent to have a bill designed to tell us what to do next session. I just don't think it's a good idea. Thank you.
Further discussion? Senator Mazansky, do you wish to close? Question number by Senator on third reading, final passage, House Bill 2682. Those opinion bills pass, say aye. Those no. Clerk, please call the roll.
Burdick. Burdick. Carter, Devlin, Devlin, Dingfelder, Farioli, George, Gerard, Hass, Hass, Johnson, Cruz, Metzger, Montes Anderson, Montes Anderson. Monroe, Morissette, Morse, Nelson, Pozanski, Rosenbaum, Schrader, Starr, Telfer, Verger, Walker, Whitsett, Winters, Atkinson, Bates, Bonamici, Boquist, President Courtney.
Yes.
Farioli's a no.
Voting no, Farioli, Hass, Walker, 27 ayes.
Is everybody happy? House Bill 2682, have received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk reads the next bill.
House Bill 2229, related to recommendations of Oregon Task Force on Land Use Planning and declaring an emergency.
Recognize Senator Jackie Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. President. House Bill 2229 is a major bipartisan accomplishment for Oregon's 35-year-old land use planning program. It provides immediate improvements to our state's pioneering land use system and imparts a strong framework for future improvements. Plus, these improvements are provided without the need for new taxpayer funding. Thanks to the hard work of many, including the Oregon Task Force on Land Use Planning, otherwise known as the Big Look, we have before us today something few thought possible earlier in the year, a set of workable solutions for some of the state's most contentious issues surrounding land use planning. The intent of the Big Look process was to find new ways to improve and update our unique land use system while still recognizing the value of protecting farm and forest lands and preventing sprawl. With some understandable limitations related to our current fiscal situation, this bill successfully answers the challenge. In sum, House Bill 2229 will establish overarching principles to guide our land use program into the 21st century. It establishes a clear process for counties to correct zoning map problems on rural lands. It revises current law to simplify and encourage more regional planning. It establishes priorities for infrastructure investments in rapidly growing area. It authorizes a complete review of land use statutes, goals, and rules to reduce complexity, and it encourages mediation of local land use disputes. Based on extensive public input and other evaluations, the task force learned that the current land use program has succeeded in preserving our state's farm and forest lands and reducing urban sprawl, but several key adjustments could be made. Recommendations for achieving these key adjustments are reflected in this bill. House Bill 2229 provides a series of strategic adjustments designed to improve our land use program for all Oregonians. This bill is mindful of our state's critical budget challenges, but still provides important improvements to our state's land use system that can be addressed now, along with a strategy for policy implementation and investment in the future. Colleagues, I ask for your aye vote, and I request the call of the Senate.
Thank you. Recognize Senator Joanne Berger.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I want to be sure that I recognize the hard work that has gone into this bill by a number of people and the intent of the bill. And my good senator, I just tried to look up her designation, so I'm going to say from Portland because I'm not sure how she wants to be recognized on the floor. But I think there's a reason why we need to read bills very carefully. I think the intent that the task force had was to improve things and make things better. Sometimes in the discussion and negotiation of things, bills get watered down or they get strengthened and they make some mistakes and leave a few things wrong. And I just want to share with some of you the things that worry me a little bit about this bill. In sections 5 through 7, it lays the ground rules. As my good colleague said, this is corrective remapping and proper zoning. We all would like to have that. That's good. We want things zoned in the proper way. But then if you go down from 5 through 7, then you get to a place that it says that the person who participates in these proceedings leading to the county's decision under these ground rules cannot raise an issue on the review before the commission, that's the DLCD, that was not raised in local proceedings. Now, I have a little bit of a problem with that because I think that things happen, times change, maybe you didn't get to every meeting, and I think that's a pretty strict rule. The other thing is that after all said and done, and the regions get together and problem solve, it's still not a final land use decision. In fact, it's not binding until the commission says that it's binding. Well, then there's been a lot of work by a lot of local people, and it comes down to that same process that we have too many times, that we see a lot of local people do a lot of things, and it comes down to a smaller group making the final decision. But, Mr. President, this is the part of the bill that really disturbed me the most. In areas, this is Section 14, in areas of the state that are growing rapidly, state agencies, as defined in the ORS, cities and counties, should, within constraints of applicable federal law and regulations, state law and rules and local ordinances, consider directing major public infrastructure investments, including major transportation investments, to reinforce compact urban developments. Consider giving priority to investments that promote infill or redevelopment of existing urban areas to encourage the density necessary to support alternative modes of transportation. Mr. President, that disturbs me, that our major transportation infrastructure should be built around urban areas, because I happen to be a coastal representative that has a lot of transportation needs. But if those investments are going to take into consideration how dense can we make these urban areas so that we can have alternative modes of transportation, then I have a problem with that. And then the final thing that gives me a problem is there's going to be a work group. Now, we've had the local folks that have been through their process and ground rules, and then they don't have a lot of say, because unless they've been very persuasive, the commission still will make the decision. And so I don't know exactly. There's a lot of good stuff in this bill. There's really a lot of work going into the bill. But I've shared with you, Mr. President, a few of the things in the bill that I find very disturbing. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you. I recognize Senator Brian Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. President. I just wanted to be on record. I voted for this bill in committee, and I always get a chuckle out of all the other committee members because I either vote yes, no, or I give a percentage. And this bill I gave a percentage on, and everybody always looks at me, and this earned a 70%. And everybody says, well, what's a 70%? How do you do these percentages? Well, my son gets grounded at 69%, so that's a no-go. So this is a lot of work went into this, and it's a 70% bill, just as the good senator from Coos Bay said.
He votes yes. Recognize Senator Jason Atkinson.
To the bill. Mr. President, I rise in a very forceful opposition to House Bill 2229. Colleagues, do you know what this bill has cost the taxpayers? Does anybody know? Do you know how much money this bill has cost taxpayers? This bill has cost taxpayers $1.4 million. $1.4 million of taxpayer money was spent to come up with House Bill 2229. And in my estimation, this bill does very little, if anything. This bill is all bull and no steak. This is a bill put together, dressed up to streamline and task force and all the rest of it, that does absolutely nothing. This bill is a product of two groups that should make you skeptical. One is an activist agency. Agencies are supposed to respond and are supposed to be directed by the policy-making bodies, which is the Oregon Senate and the Oregon House of Representatives. Agencies are not supposed to be activists. They're not supposed to be lobbyists. They're not supposed to go out and set the policy. That is our job. But in this particular bill, the agency has been the activist. The other product of this, that hands are all over this, is lobby organizations. Lobbyists are sponsoring this bill because they're either in it to make money or to protect money that someone else is making. But we all know that this bill has cost the taxpayers money under the dressing of taxpayer input, and it does absolutely nothing. Let me tell you something else that comes up in the bill. The good senator from Coos Bay brought up the regional problem-solving buzzword. In Southern Oregon, regional problem-solving has been sped up, especially under this bill. Regional problem-solving might now get completed in 8 years rather than in 7 years. This gives all of the power to the regulators and none to the regulatees. The activist agency can still wake up in the morning with an axe to grind and make it miserable on somebody that they don't like. Is that fair? No. Is that how an agency is supposed to act? No. Is that the policy that you're endorsing by voting aye on this bill? Absolutely. $1.4 million was spent, Mr. President, to create this bill that most people believe does nothing, but we have to do something is the reason why this bill is on the floor today. You have to get something. You have to show progress. Well, this is hardly progress, and this should be an embarrassment if we actually believed in task forces. Listen, the task force, when it first came up, I voted against it. When it came up a second time, I voted against it. When the third time it came up, I voted against it. Why? On the very simple principle that everyone here is a member of a task force. It's called the Oregon State Senate. That is our job. I am so tired of us spending money on a task force to make recommendations when the game is rigged. Mr. President, with all due respect, $1.4 million of taxpayer money to come up with a do-nothing bill so that an activist agency can say, we got something, is wrong. I would urge, I know that the whip is about to be cracked, but I would urge that this bill die on the basic principle of we know what the problems are with land use planning. We know that we don't have the ability to solve problems on our own. We know that centralized land use planning has made affordable housing almost impossible in Oregon. We know that an activist agency can take a local process like in Jefferson County and destroy it because someone woke up on the wrong side of the bed. We know this is bad policy. Just because $1.4 million of taxpayer money was spent does not make this a good yes vote. I would urge a very hearty no vote.
Recognize Senator Ted Farioli.
Thank you, Mr. President. I rise in opposition to this bill. Colleagues, the bill actually establishes that the Land Conservation and Development Commission, LCDC, shall review the land use responsibilities and the authorities given to the state. So the LCDC is going to review the authorities that the legislature has given to the state of Oregon, and to the counties, and to the cities, and it will make recommendations which it will pursue in the legislature. Colleagues, this modifies provisions related to the county comprehensive plans, and it directs that the counties, when they decide to modify the plans, which they must to update those plans, that before they undertake that update, they'll submit their agenda for approval to LCDC. So LCDC, in effect, will dictate policy to the state legislature, and counties can't even discuss an issue without the approval of LCDC. Can't have it on their agenda without an approval from LCDC. When the counties do intend to modify their plans, they must submit this scope of work for approval. It directs the counties to submit their decisions on planning and zoning and rezoning to LCDC for review. So literally, it puts LCDC in charge of all county planning. It directs DLCDC to participate in the collaborative regional problem-solving process if requested by a county. It provides the authority to the LCDC to grant, deny, remand, or approve proposed changes to the comprehensive land use plans of counties. So counties, in fact, have no land use authority left under this bill. LCDC has to agree. And it changes the way appeals could be formed and heard by the Court of Appeals. Colleagues, it was an honest effort to look at land use planning in Oregon in the previous legislative session, and it became known as the Big Look. And when it looked like the Big Look was going to actually make recommendations to decentralize land use planning in the state of Oregon and give the counties and local jurisdictions more planning authority, it was derailed by the governor. He canceled it. So the Big Look became a big joke. And this big joke's moved forward, and the report from the big joke committee's been published. Well, what happened to the recommendations? Well, those recommendations have run into the big fix. And the fix is in, colleagues. LCBC is going to run land use in Oregon. So the big joke becomes the big fix. A vote for this bill is very, very simple. A vote for this bill affirms that Mike makes right, and the end justifies the means, and the governor says, I'll decide, and he'll use his state agency lackey to get the job done. This is essentially, colleagues, a repudiation of 30 years of land use policy in Oregon that's inclusive, tumultuous, but essentially based on participation by the general public and a trust in local elected officials. That's what was intended with Senate Bill 100. This bill actually repeals land use planning in Oregon as we have known it and vests all of the authority in a state agency that's shown its willingness to do whatever it's told by the administration. Mr. President, this day goes down in history. This is an historic day, Mr. President. I urge a no vote on this bill, colleagues.
Recognize Senator Bruce Starr.
Thank you, Mr. President. I stand in opposition to House Bill 2229. This bill, colleagues, perpetuates the myth that Oregon's one-in-the-nation kind of land use planning is responsible for Oregon's quality of life. So what do we get with this bill? What do we get with Oregon's land use planning system? Well, one thing we get is some of the highest priced land anywhere in the country. Why? It makes sense. Hello? When you restrict supply of something, what happens? Prices go up. Why is it that housing is so unaffordable in Oregon? It's not rocket science. It's economics. I learned it in Econ 101. You probably did too. Supply and demand. You restrict supply of something, the prices go up. It also restricts freedom. It restricts freedom of the property owners to use and develop their land as they so choose, as the market might dictate. This bill, as we've heard, further usurps local government's authority in planning of their local community. Doesn't add anything in that respect. Compact urban development. Sounds great. In fact, sounds wonderful. Come to my district and see how it's worked. Compact urban development. What you get with compact urban development is you get postage stamp sized lots, or you get town houses. You get no places for kids to play, no backyards, no ability for families to recreate together in their own piece of heaven. In a lot that actually can support a family. What else do you get with compact urban development? You get traffic congestion, inordinate amount of traffic congestion. Oh, well, let's build transit because then you don't have that traffic congestion. Well, we tried that too. Colleagues, we've spent billions of dollars in transit in the Portland metropolitan area, billions. What do we have? We have compact urban development and billions of dollars in transit. And what do we have? We still have congestion. Why? Because the billions of dollars that we spend on transit is a complete and total waste of money. But we're going to spend more on light rail. That's what I'm talking about primarily. We could actually spend transit dollars well that would actually serve Oregonians and serve the Portland area, but we don't. We waste it on a fixed route, fixed line system that only serves a small percentage of the people that might otherwise be served by a transit system that might work. But we waste billions of dollars to support this compact urban development that ruins the quality of life for the vast majority of the citizens that are forced to live in these small lots because they can't afford anything else because we've driven up the cost of land. So, Mr. President and colleagues, what have we learned? What have we learned with this experiment with Oregon's land use system that this bill perpetuates? What have we learned?
Well, what we've learned is that Oregon, with this wonderful land use system, is perpetually in the top five in unemployment. Today, we're number two in the nation. We might be actually be number one. There's a reason why that is, and I don't believe that this is a stretch at all to say, well, Oregon's land use system has something to do with unemployment. Is there any other state in the union, nation, that has land use planning to the degree that restricts their citizens' freedom to the degree that we do in Oregon? And we're surprised when Oregonians are unemployed, the numbers that they are, when we come to a tough economic stint. Even in good economic times, Oregon's unemployment rate is in the top in the nation. This is not the time to further perpetuate the myth that land use planning in Oregon is positive for Oregonians. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you. Recognize Senator Fred Gerard.
Thank you, Mr. President, to the bill. Colleagues, I think the good senator from Hillsborough did a wonderful job, and so I'll be very, very brief. This bill is going to cost lots of jobs, and my district can ill afford to lose any more jobs. And it is based on a premise, and that premise is what's good in Portland and what's good in Eugene is good for the rest of the state. It's a poor premise. It's going to cost jobs. No is a good vote.
Thank you. Recognize Senator Jeff Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. President. Colleagues, I was a senior across the street at Willamette in 1973 when Senate Bill 100 was passed. Interestingly enough, my faculty advisor was on the task force that created Senate Bill 100. Fast forward 28 years later, I'm across the street again at my daughter's graduation from Willamette, and amazingly enough, her faculty advisor was the same gentleman. His name was Dr. Russ Beaton. We had a conversation about many things, and he brought the subject up. And what he said was, this is not how our land use system was supposed to look. This was one of the creators of Senate Bill 100. And he said, this is not how our land use system is supposed to look. Has anybody wondered why no other state in 30 years has followed our example and gone to centralized land use planning? The reason is it doesn't work. In the 30 years plus, it's more than that now, since the passage of Senate Bill 100, if you compare Oregon and California, Oregon has developed per capita far more prime farmland than the state of California has, without a centralized land use system, by the way. To perpetuate this system in any way, shape, or form is ridiculous. In the late 70s, after this was passed, I was on a local planning advisory committee in Douglas County. Douglas County was one of the last counties to adopt the statewide land use plan, because Douglas County didn't agree with what the state said Douglas County should do as far as development. I always thought it should have been the other way around. Colleagues, in the years we have talked about regionalization of DLCD, my suggestion has always been, let's make 36 regions, let's give land use back to the counties, and let them make the decisions that are appropriate for them. This agency has prohibited growth in my part of the state. This agency is keeping us with an incredibly high rate of unemployment, higher than any place in the Willamette Valley. Senate Bill 100 was designed to deal specifically with issues in the Willamette Valley. The impacts on the rest of the state have been stark and dramatic. This bill perpetuates a broken system that needs to be abolished. I urge a no vote.
Recognize Senator Doug Whitsitt.
Thank you, Mr. President, to the bill. Mr. President, I voted for the Big Look Task Force, and unfortunately, their performance has caused me to be embarrassed by that vote. Mr. President, as you know, I have a big district, and I attended two of the Big Look Task Force meetings. Mr. President, they were nothing short of orchestrated advocacy for land use planning. They had poignant videos, and they had impassioned speeches. Mr. President, they had everything but pom-pom girls in the advocacy of the land use planning system. Some thought I was a masochist for going the second time, but I couldn't believe that the first meeting that I attended was going to be the norm. It was. The people were angry. I mean, the people were furious in those two meetings that I attended. They went there to listen to what they thought and participate in what they thought would be an open forum on the reform of the land use system, and what they got was orchestrated advocacy. Mr. President, I believe this bill is orchestrated advocacy, and I'll be a no vote. Thank you.
Further discussion? Senator Dingfield, you wish to close?
I do. Thank you, Mr. President. I apologize for jumping the gun on call the Senate, which I'll do in a minute. Colleagues, I'm going to say something that is going to surprise you. I actually agree with a good senator from John Day. This bill does not go far enough. However, it is a compromise bill. There's a lot of parties that worked hard to come together on this bill, including during the testimony in the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. We heard from Oregonians in Action say that they support the bill and the amendments. The Association of Oregon Counties said this is a major step forward for local governments, especially sections 5 through 7. We heard from the Home Builders Association that this is an important step. There's still some issues that need to be worked out that will continue during the interim, and the realtors supported the bill, felt it was a good compromise. There's been a lot of discussion about this bill. I did want to address a concern that was raised by the good senator from District 5 regarding the task force. This was a suggestion based on the remaining needs to review our land use planning statutes. As you know, colleagues, and I have a background in land use planning, and I'm the first to admit that we have a fairly complicated land use planning system in Oregon. So the idea was to involve the Law Commission in helping the Commission and the Legislature review our existing statutes and how we can streamline and clean up our existing statutes and make it more workable for local communities in the state. So I think that this section, it's under Section 17, is a good addition to the bill. I think we need some certified smart folks, with all due respect to the attorneys in this body, to help the land use planners, the folks at LCDC, legislators here, review our 30 years of land use planning laws that have been developed over the years and have a comprehensive review and recommendation back to the legislature on these changes. Obviously, the commission can't make changes in statute. We need to do that. So that was why that provision was put in. So with respect to all of the discussion here today, I do believe this is a step forward. It's not as far as I had hoped and not as far as a lot of people had hoped, but it's a good compromise bill. I ask your aye vote, and now I respectfully request to call the Senate.
Senator Jackie Winters, excuse me, Senator Jackie Dingfelder has demanded a call to the Senate. She is joined by Senator Devlin and Senator Rosenbaum. The door clerks will bar the doors, and the Sergeant of Arms will attend. The clerk, please call the roll.
Atkinson. Bates. Bates. Bonamici. Boquist. Burdick. Carter. Carter. Devlin. Dingfelder. Ferrioli. George. Girard. Hass. Johnson. Cruz. Metzger. Montes Anderson. Monroe. Morissette. Morse. Nelson. Przanski. Rosenbaum. Schrader. Starr. Telfer. Verger. Walker. Walker. Whitsett. Winters. President Courtney.
Here.
So we're looking for Senator Carter and Senator Walker. Senator Walker is in the phone booth, and Senator Carter Senator Carter's here. So all ready to go? Waiting for Senator Bates to return to the floor. All those subject to the call are now present. The question now arises upon a third reading, the final passage of House Bill 2229. All those opinion bills are passed, say aye. And those opposed, no. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Carter. Devlin. Dingfelder. Farioli. George. Gerard. Cass. Johnson. Cruz. Metzger. Montes Anderson. Monroe. Morissette. Morse. Nelson. Pozanski. Rosenbaum. Schrader. Starr. Telfer. Ferger. Walker. Walker. Whitsett. Winters, Atkinson, Bates, Bonamici, Boquist, Burdick, President Courtney.
Yes.
Voting no, Atkinson, Boquist, Farioli, George, Gerard, Cruz, Morse, Nelson, Starr, Telfer, Ferger, Whitsett, Winters, 17 ayes.
The House Bill 2229 have received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Without objection, excuse me, recognize Senator Jason Atkinson. What purpose?
Vote explanation, Mr. Senator.
File your vote explanation.
I voted no on this bill for a whole variety of reasons regarding task forces, but I just have one thing to point out. The reason why so many lobbying organizations, Association of Oregon Counties, Home Builders, and Thousand Friends of Oregon and all the rest of them supported this last bill is because they are paid to go to the meetings. They are paid. It is not a task force of citizens. They are paid lobbyists who have a financial interest. Mr. President, that is not a reason to support that bill. That's why I voted no.
Without objection, the remaining House measures will be carried over till tomorrow's calendar. Message from the House, please.
Mr. President, I'm directed by the Speaker to inform that House has passed House Bills 5010, 5016, 5026, 5035, 5039, 2118, 2200, 3225, 5007, adopted House Resolution 7, Senate Concurrent Resolution 17, concurrent Senate Amendments, and repassed House Bills 2058, 2059, 2371, 2702, 2839, 3343, 3450, and House Bill 3089, the House refused to concur in the Senate Amendments, Conference Committee to be appointed, House Bill 3099, Representative Nolan Chair, Representative Esquivel, and Representative Garrett appointed House conferees.
Without objection, the Senate will revert to the first reading of House measures.
House Bill 5010, relating to financial administration of the Employment Department, appropriating money and declaring an emergency. House Bill 5016, relating to financial administration of the State Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, appropriating money and declaring an emergency. House Bill 5026, relating to financial administration of the State Library, appropriating money and declaring an emergency. House Bill 5035, relating to financial administration of the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, appropriating money and declaring an emergency. House Bill 5039, relating to financial administration of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, appropriating money and declaring an emergency. House Bill 2118, relating to licensing boards. House Bill 2200, relating to programs administering the State Building Code and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3225, relating to ballot measure 49-2007 claims and declaring an emergency. House Bill 5007, relating to financial administration of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, appropriating money and declaring an emergency.
Transfer to the President's desk for referral. Other business, Senate. Under announcement, Senator Ferrier, Senator Rich Devlin first.
Thank you, Mr. President, Senate colleagues. Senate Democrats, get your lunch and be in the caucus room at 1225. We've got a lot of work to do.
Recognize Senator Ted Ferrioli, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. Republicans will get their lunches and go immediately, just one floor upstairs to the caucus room. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you. Recognize Senator Jenny Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senate Finance and Revenue will meet at 1:30.
Are there any other announcements? If there are no further announcements, without objection, the Senate is adjourned until 9:45 tomorrow, which is Tuesday, June 16th. The Senate is now adjourned.